other marine predators thrived in the Humboldt Current in a way perhaps not that different from today. Then, iron runoff to the coast from nearby rivers fueled widespread and toxic algal blooms that killed legions of marine mammals of all stripes and ages. And they killed these top consumers rather rapidly, perhaps within hours, through asphyxiation, the awful way that algal poisons suddenly kill whales in the modern world. Seals, sloths, and even billfishes were not immune to the widespread effects of algal neurotoxicity either. Wave action and currents, sometimes even storm surges, pushed carcasses close to shore over the course of days to weeks. The carcasses of the largest whales arrived mostly on their backs, belly up, except when waves occasionally turned a few over. Ending up in the northern corner of the broad tidal flat, the carcasses were concentrated, like a logjam on a river, until the tide passed out, stranding the carcasses on the flat. The three whales that made up La Familia were among probably hundreds of others. They were likely related to one another at a population level and were buried as they lived together. They mostly rested intact, flesh scavenged by sawtooth seabirds and crabs until they were buried slowly. This sequence of events happened over the course of at least four different episodes several thousands of years apart, each time ending in the exact same spot, producing a stack of skeletons that would later become Cerobaena. Over the course of millions of years, the stack of rocks from the ancient tidal flats were uplifted by tectonic activity, rising nearly 200 feet above sea level. During this time, the forces of compaction and chemical replacement flattened the skeletons and turned them to rock, especially with weight of the overlying strata, an aggregate of shells called a coquina, deposited during the ice ages. This whole stack of rocks rested on the northern edge of the Caldera Basin, overlooking Caldera and El Moro to the south. It would take until the late 20th century for the first road cuts to blaze a path through these strata, destroying any number of skeletons, and then until the 21st century for our story to take place, measuring, scanning, and cataloging all of the bones for removal and their digital legacy. I originally went to Chile to understand the material ways that past ecosystems were different from the oceans of today. In essence, did walrus whales, aquatic sloths, and bony-toothed seabirds matter? I also wanted to know how the differences between ancient and modern species arose over geologic time, which chronicles the rise of whales and other large consumers as important ecological players. What we discovered through the long but ultimately valuable diversion of Cerobaena was that dense concentrations of bones can also provide some of the most telling ecological snapshots of these systems. In two football fields of highway road cut, we sampled a complete list of nearly all known marine mammal species in South America, from walrus whales to aquatic sloths. It would not be surprising if we found other species known from elsewhere in Chile and Peru. Should anyone ever excavate farther into the sidewalls of the road cut? By our estimates, there's another million meters of rock at the site with that preservation potential, amounting to hundreds of possible La Familias of walrus whales, seals, and other species. The story of Cerobaena is probably not unique in the whole of Chile, nor even South America. Anytime we see recurring events in the geologic record, it tells us something important about broader processes in Earth's systems. If our argument about the repeated mass strandings at Cerobaena is true, then there should be fossil whale highways elsewhere in the world. Anywhere, at least, where the traces of upwelling zones get preserved by plate tectonics, along with embayments, tidal flats, and killer algae. Specifically, we can look to westerly continental coastlines around the world, where there are pockets of an accessible fossil record and the right environments preserved in the rocks. Geopolitics was the impetus for the discovery of Cerobaena. It may take this kind of serendipity to find others as well. And what should be true for whale mass strandings should apply equally to mosasaurs, ichthyosaurs, or any other kind of oceanic consumer in the past, given the deep antiquity of single-celled organisms that have been causing harmful algal blooms for nearly a billion years. While most other marine mammal bone beds are the result of prolonged processes preserving bones on the seafloor, Cerobiana was notably different, a tidal flat that preserved loads of carcasses that were physically concentrated by wave and storm action and preserved in dense intervals. This density of individual fossil marine mammal skeletons found at Cerobiana is unrivaled by any other site in the world, whether it's Sharktooth Hill or even Wadi al-Hitan. I've always thought that the window Cerobiana reveals about the Humboldt Current in deep time puts it on par with other UNESCO World Heritage sites, including Wadi al-Hitan. And we're fortunate that the accessible digital legacy that we built is available right now to anyone with an internet connection, because there is still so much to learn. East of El Moro, the foothills give rise to the Andes, which form the spine of the entire South American continent. They are a dramatic consequence of the Nazca Plate's long-term plunge beneath the greater continental South American plate, pushing strata to elevation the way pages of a thick book roll in a soft cover. The rocks in this part of the Andes are much older than Cerobiana, some as old or older than the first dinosaurs. In this region, not more than a day's drive away from Cerobiana, sits another result of the collision between geopolitics and science. Hyper-arid desert air, the highest elevations in the Americas, and locations far from urban centers of light pollution make for the perfect place to mount the world's most advanced astronomical observatories. The Smithsonian's first solar observatories were also based here, built at the turn of the 20th century, long since surpassed by fortresses containing telescopes that peer billions of years into the universe's past. Astronomy and paleontology are sibling fields, really. They take human imagination to places where no person has ever been, and they are endeavors entirely open to contributions from anyone, so long as you have the persistence to join the hunt. Any day, an amateur might find a comet or a fossil that forever changes textbooks. It's happened before, and it will happen again. Astronomers even hijack the word fossil as an analogy for the light from distant stars, novae, and galaxies, a diverse bestiary of phenomena not unlike the assemblages of extinct forms buried and occasionally exhumed from rock. We both need data, whether from time on the telescope or hands and knees on the ground, scraping for bones. When our truck finally pulled up to Punta Referencia, raucous cheers of excitement greeted our lagging team. Tuareg sauntered in to a hero's welcome of hugs and kisses on the cheek. I held back near the truck, away from the warm glow, to take a quick peek at the clearing night sky. I was hoping to catch sight of the Southern Cross, something I could never do at home. I walked towards the beach, past two dogs tussling in the shadows, until the alleyway gave way to a full view of the sky's blue and purple dome. Only a few hundred light years away, most of the stars in the four-pronged kite of the Southern Cross had been glowing for at least 10 million years before dozens of Miocene whales washed up at Cerobiana. I thought about how the starlight above and the fossils beneath our feet existed long before the first human tribes craned their heads to the night sky and will persist long after the last humans become extinct. Against that, in the here and now, we hunt for real things about the past, pixels of light or worn bones, that give us a material way to interact with scales of time far outside our own. Famished and a bit lonely, I returned to the restaurant, tucking in shoulder to shoulder with students shivering in fleece and nylon jackets. But the cool air hardly mattered as the beer and jokes flowed, along with freshly fried seafood spilling across the wood table. Many of my Chilean colleagues were children of the dictatorship years. They had no real intellectual continuity with their predecessors, yet they succeeded in finding their way. The ringleader, Tuareg, held court, drawing extinct, taxonomically appropriate centaurs of everyone on bar napkins. Caro was a long-beaked river dolphin. I was a walrus whale. One of Caro's students leaned toward me. This is classic Tuareg. You will find cartoons like these on napkins in every cafe, from Antofagasta to Punta Arenas. I believed it. I imagined Tuareg's trail of cartoon napkins and cell phones across the skinny spine of Chile. In the end, science is not a solitary endeavor. It takes partnership. Whether it's massive teams to ply the night skies with telescopes on mountaintops, or Legion ship crews to carry naturalists across many oceans, or paleontologists gathered at a bright, friendly spot off the Fossil Whale Highway. Tuareg deserved full credit for first realizing the scope of Cerro Baena and persisting through my doubts. I was happy to direct the digital salvage of the site and pull together the evidence we needed to figure out how Cerro Baena came to be. With my seat at the table, I felt lucky to be a part of it all. And, in that moment at Punta Referencia, didn't feel especially much like a foreigner. Instead, I felt like just another fossil hound, gathered at the evening's campfire to share news of the day's discoveries and a bit of gossip. Part 2. Present. Chapter 8. The Age of Giants. Take in a deep breath, and now relax. You just shared oxygen with the largest animal ever in the history of life on Earth. In a single blow, this animal expels a column of water vapor that would reach the top of a two-story house. The air that passed through its lungs is enough to fill half a cement mixer truck. Its blood cells pass through a heart with vessels the diameter of dinner plates and run through a body with over 20 billion miles of arteries, capillaries, and veins. Blood must carry oxygen to every cell in this animal, all 1,000 trillion of them, including nerves whose fibers reach over 100 feet from its brainstem to every extremity, including its tail fluke. With a flip of its fluke, the animal descends to a depth beyond the limits of light, where it makes the most acoustically powerful sound made by any organism, a low tone that spreads for over 900 miles, echoing off undersea canyons. Everything about this animal, in all the ways that we can measure, is superlative. This animal is, of course, a blue whale. Extremes enthrall us all, and the idea of an ultimate size champion among living things is a captivating thought. Ask an elementary school kid about the biggest animal of all time, and the short list of possible contenders very quickly becomes a battle between two titans, a blue whale versus a sauropod dinosaur. This comparison is enshrined in textbooks, usually with a stylized composition of a blue whale, mid-gulp, floating above a sauropod, sloping neck and tail extending in opposite directions. Sometimes you might see a string of African elephants or school buses for scale. The winner of this runoff, of course, depends a bit on how you measure the contestants. The longest of the sauropod dinosaurs probably exceeded 110 feet in total length, based on relatively complete skeletons. That linear distance comes close to the longest blue whale ever measured, a 109-foot female from the Southern Ocean, killed in 1926 by Norwegian whalers. But whales are the true heavyweights. At most, the largest sauropods might have weighed 120 tons, but the best estimates place the largest ones closer to 70 tons. By comparison, the heaviest blue whale reliably measured, a female, also from the Southern Ocean, weighed 136.4 tons, or just over 300,000 pounds, more than the takeoff weight of a Boeing 757. And this particular whale was only an 89-foot-long female. A blue whale closer to 100 feet, especially if pregnant, would have weighed much more. From the standpoint of biomass, it's not much of a contest. Blue whales are the most massive animals ever in the history of life, and we just happen to live alongside them. For us, a whale size may be the most striking thing about them, but the fascination is not just about sheer bulk. How can a creature of that magnitude keep itself alive? Size determines a lot about how much air a whale needs, how deep it can dive, how much food it needs to eat, and how far it can swim. But step back for a moment from these physiological questions. How did whales become giants in the first place? We know the beginning and end points. Within the 50 million years that took whales from land ancestry to dominance in the oceans, the weight difference between Pachycetus and a blue whale increased about 10,000 times. How exactly did this change unfold? And how can we know? Those questions loomed over me for many years. As a graduate student, I began to chip away at them, starting with the question of whether the roles extinct whales played in past ecosystems were similar to the niches they filled today, or if those ancient roles had since become obsolete. As a student, I had already read enough about walrus whales, for instance, to know that there were some cast members of past whale worlds that lacked any descendants. I also spent a lot of time measuring whale skulls, keeping a log of the same set of measurements for every specimen I encountered. I knew the more data points I had, the more useful the information would be in helping me, and others, predict the total length of any fossil whale when only the skull was available. As mentioned previously, whole skeletons, nose to tail, are essentially never recovered, Cerobaena notwithstanding. I came to realize something odd about the fossil record of both baleen whales and toothed whales as well. None of them were as big as even their middling descendants today. I hadn't deeply probed this surmise with analytical tools. At the time, I was more focused on the challenge of reconstructing a single whale's body size, given scanty inputs. But I knew there was something to my observation. At Wadi al-Hitan in Egypt, perhaps the best snapshot into the life of whales during the late Eocene, Basilosaurus was the whale titan. Yet it was only as long as today's humpback whales, a mid-sized baleen whale at about 50 feet long, and weighed probably 5 to 6 times less with its comparatively much smaller head, short chest cavity, and long tail. At Sharktooth Hill in California, the largest whales were even shorter, no more than 30 or so feet long. While those Miocene whales had modern proportions, none were nearly as large as a modern humpback. For all the millions of bone shards in the Sharktooth Hill bone bed, not a single one represented a fossil whale species that remotely approached the gigantic sizes of today's blue whales. I didn't know what to make of the broad observation and repeatedly pushed the issue back under more immediate layers of inquiry. But the question always resurfaced. Years later, at the Smithsonian, I came across a postdoctoral research fellow who could finally help me get to the answer. Now a professor, Graham Slater specializes in analyzing evolutionary trends in the fossil record. Using my working file of skull measurements, we charted the sizes of all living and fossil species across their family tree. We focused particularly on baleen whales, excluding toothed whales, which feed at a variety of water depths, by echolocating on prey. We finally had an evolutionary map for how size evolved in whales over the past 30 or so million years. Our analysis revealed that very large body size in baleen whales had evolved several times across different lineages. Extreme gigantism in whales, body lengths of more than 60 feet or weights over 200,000 pounds, appeared on different parts of the tree in species unrelated to one another. Blue whales and fin whales, the longest and second longest whales today, for example, are actually not very closely related to each other. And neither of these whales is particularly closely related to right and bowhead whales, which can, at their maximum sizes, also tip the scales at 100 tons. When a notable feature arises several times on distantly related branches of an evolutionary tree, it's a sure sign that something interesting is going on. Our evolutionary tree mapping also confirmed another fact I knew casually. The world today is devoid of very small baleen whales, compared with other times in the geologic past. Many of the fossil baleen whales that Remington Kellogg described in detail, including those from Sharktooth Hill, were very small. In some cases, their skulls were small enough to cradle in your arms. The total length of these filter-feeding whales would have been about the size of a car, similar in size or smaller than today's enigmatic pygmy right whale, the smallest baleen whale. In the past 15 million years or so, whales at this size seemed relatively common in the fossil record. Our analysis showed that they went extinct very recently, some species only a few million years ago. Past whale worlds were different, based on the story of size alone. At this evolutionary moment, we live in an age of giants, sharing our planet with the largest whales ever, some of which are the largest animals to ever exist, period, in the history of life. There's nothing the size of today's blue whales, fin whales, or any of the skim-feeding whales in the fossil record. The immediate questions then become these ones. What drove the history of these changes in the fossil record of baleen whales? Does it have more to do with the whales themselves or the worlds they lived in? What's preventing them from getting even bigger? You might expect baleen to hold some answers. Baleen whales are, after all, the largest of all whales, and they have a unique anatomical apparatus that makes them stand apart from all other mammals, alive or extinct. Look inside the mouth of a whale, and you'll know immediately which of the two major living groups it belongs to. If it has rows and rows of plastic-like plates hanging from the roof of its mouth, it's a baleen whale. If it doesn't, it's a toothed whale. Toothed whales all echolocate, and despite their name, a few species don't actually have teeth, as they hardly need to chew or break up their food after seizing or sucking it into their mouths. Baleen is a soft, pliable structure made up of keratin, just like fingernails, hooves, and hair. It grows from the roof of the mouth soon after a whale's birth, emerging in a series of plates, numbering in the hundreds, which form a rack-like structure. These triangular plates are ensconced in a bed of flesh, are fed by blood vessels and nerves, and grow in layers, the way our own nails and hair do. Baleen develops frayed edges as its tubules are worn down from the friction of feeding. These tubules spring outward, like uncooked spaghetti, interdigitating with tubules from adjacent baleen plates to form a mesh facing the inside of the mouth. When baleen whales close their mouths around a gulp of water laden with krill, fish, or other zooplankton, the racks of baleen create a filter that traps prey inside. So how long has baleen been around? And how does it relate to whale gigantism? It turns out that the first baleen whales didn't have baleen, meaning, yes, they once had teeth. There are three major pieces of evidence that underlie this point. First, baleen whale fetuses have tooth buds, primordial bits of tooth enamel and dentin, resorbed by the body prior to birth. Baleen itself grows from ridges on the roof of the mouth during the first year of life, but in the womb, the genetic machinery for creating teeth is still in place, a vestige of baleen whale's deep past as much as tiny hind limbs in Basilosaurus. Second, baleen whales share common ancestry with toothed whales. These two branches that comprise the surviving houses of the whale family tree diverged around 35 million years ago, during the last days of Basilosaurus. The first baleen whales hardly looked anything like a blue whale. They looked more like an extremely shortened version of Basilosaurus, with tiny versions of jagged saw blade teeth lining their mouth. They weren't eel-like in body proportions, but built more along the lines of a bottlenose dolphin. But we know that these first toothed members of the lineage that eventually led to filter-feeding whales are more closely related to blue whales than they are to any dolphin, because they share key traits located in their unique, pebble-like ear bones. Third, although baleen is a soft tissue structure, it does occasionally show up in the fossil record. Its preservation may have to do with the unique chemical environment on the seafloor. Fossil baleen has been reported from rocks in California and Peru, although no more than about 15 million years in age, about half as old as the oldest baleen whales. One important caveat is how we define whale groups when talking about baleen whales. Because the earliest baleen whales didn't have baleen, describing these extinct forerunners using common words is challenging. Scientific nomenclature helps. Mysticetes, instead of baleen whales. Odontocetes, instead of toothed whales. At some point on the separate branches leading to today's baleen whales and toothed whales, filter feeding and echolocation evolved, respectively. We don't know exactly when, how, or how many distinct times. Consider birds and dinosaurs. When scientists discovered dinosaurs with feathers, it became clear that feathers do not necessarily make a bird. Instead, we need to define organisms as lineages separate from traits that diagnose their identity. Some scientists have proposed that early baleen whales had a combination of teeth and primordial baleen, teeth outboard, baleen inboard, but fossilized primordial baleen hasn't been found in any of the species where such a scenario might be expected. Other scientists have proposed that the first baleen whales evolved a half-and-half solution, but oriented not outside-in, as in the other proposal, but front-to-back. Front teeth still in place, but lacking them in the back half of their mouth, instead bearing a primitive ridge of baleen. Still another possibility is an intermediate state with neither teeth nor baleen, simply a toothless, gulping early baleen whale. Most of these scenarios involve interpreting fragmentary fossils that don't preserve the critical soft tissue structures. No one has yet, for instance, demonstrated how a whale with both outboard teeth and inboard baleen would actually be able to feed. Absent more fossils with clear evidence for what the first baleen plates look like, all we can do with these ideas is test them using biomechanical or computer models. Until scientists figure out a way to record video inside the mouths of today's filter-feeding whales, a logistical hurdle that may be impossible to surmount, we need to shore up our knowledge about how filter-feeding works in living baleen whales before jumping to any conclusions about how it may have worked in their ancient fossil relatives. At the Smithsonian, I can place all the skulls and jawbones from the first baleen whales from one geologic epoch on a single long table. The skulls of many of these first baleen whales, from a time called the Oligocene, around 30 million to 20 million years ago, have prominent large eye sockets and flat beak-like snouts with sockets for teeth. Some of these fossils preserve teeth in place, which makes me wonder about all the ways we could test their feeding style. The chocolate and coffee tones of the bones contrast against the gray mud and siltstone matrix that encases them. The rock matrix for bones this ancient can be so hard as to require years of careful exhumation by a pneumatic chisel, acid baths, and the sharp picks of dental tools. Many of these Oligocene whales hail from the storm-washed beaches of the Pacific Northwest and adjoining sea cliffs. Amateur scientists are responsible for nearly all of the Smithsonian's collection of fossils from this part of the world. For these fossil finders, the brutal weather can make the finds more satisfying. Winter storms wash the shores with heavy waves that pull away the sand to reveal boulder after boulder, many with bits of bone inside, if you know how to read the rocks. And, as always, you need to be lucky. The ear bones among these Oligocene fossils reveal their identity as close forerunners of today's baleen whales. Otherwise, their needle-like and slightly cusped teeth recall some kind of strange, monstrous seal. Or you might think they belong in the Cretaceous, along with marine reptiles in the time of dinosaurs. But they are indeed whales, albeit smaller versions of today's giants, transposed tens of millions of years into the geologic past. Their descendants, still alive in today's oceans, have skeletons that vastly eclipse these early whales in size. Baleen came first, then, much later, enormous sizes. Even at Cerro Baena, a site that samples the diversity of whales from 9 to 7 million years ago, no single baleen whale skeleton reaches more than about 30 feet in length. The origin of baleen doesn't neatly explain why blue whales and other filter-feeding whales became modern-day giants. We have to keep digging. Chapter 9. The Ocean's Utmost Bones. There is a set of unassuming warehouses in Prince George's County, Maryland, which hold secrets of immeasurable value. The corrugated metal sheds stand at the end of a nondescript asphalt road, where the Smithsonian keeps its off-site collections, including Apollo-era spacecraft and planes from both world wars. They also house the focus of my life's work, and that of many others, thousands upon thousands of whale bones from nearly every species alive today, and many long extinct. These vaults hold an archive of past whale worlds, ranging from geologic to historical times, that has no equal anywhere else. Once inside, the smell is the first thing you'll notice. A latent oil odor hangs in the air, still emanating from century-old skeletons. Rows of steel shelves hold the full series of vertebrae from the largest whales, the neck, chest, lumbar, and tail bones of blue whales, fin whales, right whales, and sperm whales, all stacked like giant dominoes and wedged in archival foam. The natural oil that still lingers in these skeletons smells like 1,000 wax candles charged with smoke and seaweed. For me, this dense and heady smell conjures memories and associations about these bones that have formed over years of study. When I notice the smell laced in clothes or on my hands, it reminds me that for any question about whales, there's probably a specimen in this collection that could answer it. Metal frames line the floor, 10 to 20 feet tall, each with skulls and jaws lashed to its structure, mounted upright. Casters allow one person to move the enormous specimens with comparative ease. These specimens and the thousands of bones housed in cabinets and resting on shelving represent a physical record of nearly every whale species alive today, including some yet to be named. Yes, there are still new mammal species to be formally named in the 21st century. A large portion of the fossil whale collection at the Smithsonian is stored here, providing perhaps the only place in the world where the skulls of a blue whale, a fin whale, and a number of other gigantic whale species can be compared side by side with those of their long extinct fossil relatives. With vertebrae the size of desks, jaws as large as telephone poles, and skulls that wouldn't fit inside a city apartment, the chain of human effort to bring just one of these items to the museum from its point of discovery is almost too exhausting to contemplate. Multiply that single custody chain by tens of thousands of specimens over 150 years, and the cumulative effort is staggering. There is one whale specimen, however, that stands apart from the rest. USNM 268731. Is the catalog number for the right and left jaw bones of the largest blue whale specimen in any museum in the world. I've looked for and measured all possible contenders. Nearly 23 feet long, each weighing about a dry ton weight, the bones rest horizontally on the largest custom metal frames in the collection. Neither would slide easily through any kind of normal front door. It takes half a dozen strides and a few breaths just to walk their length. Blade-like terminations mark where the two would meet to form the whale's chin. Our own right and left jaws are fused at the chin as a bony symphysis by the time we are born. At the top of each jawbone is a fine peak called the coronoid process, which provides an attachment in life for a set of strap-like muscles that pull the jaw toward the skull. Two large bumps nearby, on the other end, anchor the jaws into the skull itself. Bones this large seem improbable. It is hard to wrap your mind around something the height of a football field goalpost, attached to a moving, breathing being. In all of their fundamental dimensions, length, width, height, and weight, these bones are larger than the biggest mammoth tusks or the bones belonging to the largest dinosaurs. Blue whale jawbones are not just the ocean's utmost bones, to borrow from Melville, but the utmost bones in the history of life on Earth. Of course, they did not just appear in the museum, as if fabricated out of some incredible special effects studio. They have an origin story, like every other specimen in the museum's collection. And in this case, the story begins on an island in the middle of the Southern Ocean, about 100 years ago. The Drake Passage, a stretch of churning, frigid, and perilous seas, stretches between the southern tip of South America and the craggy archipelago of the western Antarctic Peninsula. It formed some 30 million years ago as the tectonic plates of South America and Antarctica separated, finally giving way to a continuous current system that now rings Antarctica. The circumantarctic current is unimpeded by any landform, allowing wind and waves to build incredible force, keeping albatrosses aloft and menacing navigators for centuries. This current also keeps Antarctica refrigerated and fuels the rich ecosystems that support krill, whales, seals, and penguins. For those fortunate or crazy enough to cross the Drake, the immense heave and pull that you feel under your feet, or towering waves that rattle even the sturdiest vessel, remind you that we live on a planet that frequently defies our attempts to control it. After an ill-fated expedition to cross Antarctica on foot in 1914, the explorer Sir Ernest Shackleton and his crew were marooned on an island at the tip of the Antarctic Peninsula. Crossing the Drake in open boats would have been folly. Instead, he and his crew aimed for South Georgia, nearly 800 miles away to the east, with the current, not against it. In a feat of survival essentially unparalleled in the modern age, Shackleton landed with his men on the south side of the island before making the first ever inland crossing of the glaciated island. Exhausted but unbowed, Shackleton sought a place on the east side where he knew he could find help, a whaling station. It's as unlikely a place as you might imagine for one whaling station, let alone the several that existed at South Georgia in the early 20th century. At the time, each was more like a small port town, with barracks, administrative offices, churches, and of course, factories specially designed to pull whole whale carcasses out of the water for rendering. The names for these stations conveyed claims from nations a world away: Stromness, Prince Olaf, and Kritviken, and operated under companies with different flags, including Norwegian, British, and Argentine. Today, these abandoned whaling stations are protected heritage sites under British territorial claim. But in the early 20th century, these ports were filled with smells and sights from the most massive sustained whale hunts in history, pushing many whale species in the Southern Hemisphere to the edge of extinction. South Georgia's heyday was brief, elapsing between two technological innovations. In 1864, the deck-mounted explosive harpoon made whaling much more lethally efficient. And in the late 1920s, gigantic factory ships freed whalers from the need to process their catch on land. As a seamount, the island's underwater topography created a local upwelling that naturally attracted an abundance of whales nearby, in the thousands, so many that whalers could hear their blows echoing throughout the harbor. Lacking any kind of restrictions, whalers devastated the locally abundant whales and then pursued whales farther afield in the Great Southern Ocean. At its end, Southern Ocean whaling in the 20th century accounted for over 2 million of the more than 3 million whales killed last century. The scope of this undertaking, which began on a remote island, is difficult for us to grasp today, but it rivals more widely known exterminations on land, like those of the American bison and the passenger pigeon. Shackleton's photographer, Frank Hurley, left a legacy of images collected on the expedition's initial legs southward, showing Kritviken with corrugated tin sheds next to long, wide flensing platforms, like airport tarmacs tilted into the harbor. Ice fields and jagged hillsides rise dramatically in the background. The enormous whale carcasses in the foreground are startling. In one photo, a nearly 100-foot-long blue whale dwarfs the gaggle of men beside it. Few people alive today, if any, can relate to the sight of a carcass that massive. While only about 150 blue whales were ever killed at these lengths, over 325,000 blue whales of all sizes were killed during Southern Ocean whaling in the 20th century. Today, blue whales are a rare sight in these waters. It's quite possible that the gigantic, limit-pushing blue whales have had their genes removed from the population by whaling. At the least, it will take a few more decades for any surviving calves from that era, now fully mature adults, to reach the lengths of their ancestors. While commercial whaling took a colossal and unprecedented toll on many species, it also provided unique information, creating an uneasy intersection between interests. Whaling, across geographic and temporal scopes, has given us a lot of basic biology about whales that we would not know otherwise. The sheer scale of industrial whaling was a lethal way to sample whale diversity across the world's oceans. The tabulations and maps generated out of this killing provided some estimation of what whales lived in which oceans at a specific time. Very few of these physical vouchers ever made it to a museum. Whaling in the 20th century was about profit in the form of oil and meat. But the occurrence data for each recorded kill, which species, where it was harpooned, and when, like a waypoint, also provide an account of whale biodiversity in the early 20th century that we will never get again. We do know that these data aren't entirely unbiased. Soviet whalers, especially in the North Pacific, consistently underreported their whaling catch statistics for decades. Whaling has also provided us with volumes of anatomical data. For example, our sources for total body weights, organ weights, length data, and relative timing of age to physical maturity for a variety of large whale species is derived from the whaling industry. There are also details about reproduction, birth rate, and gestation based on ovary data, for example, and diet based on gut contents, a last meal, which permit the identification of prey species in a precise and quantitative way. At the height of whaling at South Georgia in the 1920s, many of the size measurements, such as total length or girth at the pectoral flippers, became standardized, giving this kind of reporting comparability and repeatability. Sometimes even data about parasites, outside and inside the body, were collected. To support an industry of empire, the British government formalized data collection about whale landings when it convened the Discovery Investigations from 1918 to 1951. The output of this scientific inquiry into Antarctic whaling, organizing and analyzing whale data in their oceanographic context, weighed in at 37 volumes and was made publicly available. The Discovery Reports are scientific proceedings, but they also revealed the immense scale of the logistics involved in the hunts and the hardships of living and working at sea or on a remote island. When I paged through the Discovery Reports, full of tabulations, sepia photos, and line drawings, I wonder whether the scientists who collected these data recognized that the chance to do so would never happen again. One person who would have pored over the reports at the time of their publication was my direct predecessor at the Smithsonian, Remington Kellogg. I inhabit a world he created. As the current curator of fossil marine mammals at the Smithsonian, I'm the steward of the collections that he largely built. It is the largest collection of its kind in the world. By a fair margin, measured both in sheer tonnage and in variety of extinct branches of the whale family tree. Much of it was collected, handled, and contemplated by Kellogg over the course of 40 years at the National Museum. It's a rare day that I don't pause at his contorted penmanship in India ink on brittle paper in a specimen drawer. His legacy, however, also includes the fact that he was instrumental in founding the International Whaling Commission in 1946 and served as a kind of science diplomat representing the United States at the IWC until shortly before his death in 1969. Kellogg was well aware that some whale species, such as North Atlantic right whales, had been devastated by Yankee whaling less than a century before, and that other species, such as gray whales, were on the edge of extinction in the early 20th century. he successfully marshaled his colleagues to enact the first multinational prohibitions for any further hunting of right whales and gray whales in 1937 with the organization that presaged the IWC. But the scale of what Kellogg faced in the post-World War II years of whaling far outstripped anything that happened in the 19th century. In theory, the IWC was meant to regulate the killing of whales. In practice, the IWC functioned more like an international hunting club. Nations manage whales as resources, the way many fisheries do today. And for most member nations, the influence of the whaling industry outweighed any scientific interest in whales. To a degree, ignorance served their aims. If no one really knew how many whales there were in the oceans, there was no reason to abate the hunts. Kellogg's opposition was paid little heed. By the time of his death, well over 2 million large whales had been killed. There may have been only a few thousand blue whales left on the planet, less than 1% of their population at the outset of whaling. The scale of this loss of biomass in the oceans has no historical precedent. We live in a world with far fewer whales than our grandparents, and certainly than the world of our great-grandparents. The ecological consequences of this scarcity are still poorly understood. Kellogg's role in the failures of the IWC during the mid-20th century, especially as a paleontologist turned diplomat, confounds and frustrates me. His portraits depict him true to his bureaucratic type, posed at a large desk with a specimen in hand, eyes glaring from a dour face. Were the endless quiet hours of committee work and travel a matter of pride in the service of scientific diplomacy? Or did the shortcomings of diplomacy eat away at him? We know little about any of his personal thoughts about whaling. His written reflections are dry and devoid of personal asides, sadly barren of the colorful language he used in the workplace, which dominates the memory of the handful of people I know who talk to him. While some superficials about Kellogg appeal to me, they still don't help me understand him, nor help to answer the questions I want to know more than the others. What would I have done in his shoes? Was there anything to change about the fate of whales on Earth had I been in his place at his time? I ask myself that whenever I pass by the bones of USNM 268731 in the warehouses. The jaws of this massive, unparalleled creature came to rest here thanks to a rapacious greed that killed over 99% of all other whales like it. USNM 268731 belonged to a 92-foot-long female blue whale, harpooned off East Antarctica in 1939 by the whaling ship Ulysses. The vessel was a factory ship over 500 feet long that Norwegian whalers operated over several years with observers from the U.S. Coast Guard, logging 30,000 cruise miles. One sharp-eyed inspector corresponded extensively with Kellogg about the specimen collection that the ship amassed. He, or someone like him, must have taken note of USNM 268731's spectacular size, though we have no mention of these particular jawbones in anyone's notes. How exactly USNM 268731's jaws entered the collections, by boat, by crane, by truck, seems to be lost to history. The best stories of scientific discovery are, at their heart, stories about people. There's no doubt that the facts of science are exacting and objective. But the narrative of how we figure out true things about the world is not necessarily clean and tidy. That's because scientists are real people too, with inner lives that sometimes bear on their work. Scientific discoveries happen in a social context, and they can be as much a matter of happenstance as the friendships we form. Jeremy Goldbogen is one such friend who has profoundly influenced my life and my science. Jeremy is quiet and contemplative in the moments when I am loud and rash. I relish making him snicker over a profane joke. Although we have different skill sets, he's now a leading researcher in the discipline of biomechanics, or the physics of how organisms function. Our careers have been closely braided with lab work and field work around the world, tagging, dissecting, and digging whales. Friendships have origin stories too, and our shared quest to understand how whales became giants of the sea started on a walk in San Diego. On a break from one of my first field seasons at Sharktooth Hill, I met Jeremy through a mutual friend in San Diego. Like me, Jeremy was wrestling with the insecurity of not knowing exactly what to study, but his problems were far away from bones. He had recently received a set of data from one of the first generation of suction cup tags deployed on rorquals just off the coast nearby. His colleagues had hoped to collect whales singing, but instead found them feeding. At the time, no one had recognized that the tags recorded a trove of biomechanical data that could be inferred from changes in the speed of these feeding whales, but Jeremy would be among the first to figure that out. One day on a walk to grab tacos for lunch, Jeremy asked me, "How hard is it to measure rorqual jaws?" I replied that besides finding a long enough tape measure, it was mostly a matter of legwork and a strong back. But Jeremy was thinking more broadly about measuring energy. When these massive animals lunge with mouths agape, water loaded with prey pours in, generating drag at major energetic cost. Because jawbones delimit the size of whale mouths, Jeremy figured we could theoretically use bone measurements to put real numbers on how much water these whales engulfed during a single lunge. Those data, combined with tag data from their feeding bouts underwater, would give us key information about the energetic trade-offs involved with lunge feeding. Within a few months, we pooled together some small graduate student travel grants and headed to the Smithsonian, a place that could help provide exactly that kind of information. My quip to Jeremy aside, measuring whale bones is hard work. I envy my colleagues who work on land mammals or even large reptiles. They don't need forestry calipers, transect tapes, ladders, and forklifts to take simple linear measurements of their study materials. Even elephant bones don't rival those of a large whale. Just measuring the length, width, height, or circumference of the bones and skulls of rorqual whales, even the smaller ones, require thick foam blocks, moving straps, and all the coordination you'd need to move furniture. Bring gloves, ditch the nice shoes. It's minimally a two-person operation most of the time, something that Jeremy and I learned firsthand with our first visit to the Smithsonian. Over the course of 2 weeks in the warehouses, we managed to measure every rorqual jawbone we could find for a variety of rorqual species, small, medium, and large. One fact we determined out of data collection was that bigger jaws had less of a mechanical advantage than smaller ones. In other words, based on the simple lever mechanics of where the jaw muscles would pull on the jaw bone, larger rorquals should spend more effort closing their jaws, a bit like lifting a bucket of water with a broom by holding it at its end versus somewhere down the middle. That made sense in terms of behavior. Smaller rorquals, such as minkies, eat quicker prey and need to shut their mouths faster than blue whales, for example, which can afford to close their mouths more slowly around larger and slower escaping swarms of krill. In life, it may have taken USNM 68731's 92-foot-long owner as long as 10 seconds to open and close its mouth around a volume of water equal to an entire lane of an Olympic-sized swimming pool. The drop in mechanical advantage at this upper limit made us wonder about the limits to living life as a rorqual whale. Jeremy turned to the discovery reports, to table after table of raw whaling station measurements, a grind of library work and hunt and peck accounting. He thumbed through every paper and every table in the whole series to find numbers directly comparable to those we collected in museum collections, such as jaw length, as well as others that could be measured only in the flesh, such as body length and the distance between the dorsal fin and the tail fluke. The most comprehensive series of measurements in the reports were limited to fin whales. Jeremy found that bigger fin whales could hold even more water in their mouths than you'd expect for their body size. Assuming this pattern held for other rorqual species, it pointed to what was likely a benefit of being large as a lunge-feeding whale. The bigger, the better. Common sense logic added, to a point, there must be a trade-off for being big. Benefits, but also limits. Was something else at work here? Something more than we could discern from dry bones and numbers? It was a bit like trying to know a bat from either its flight path or its skeleton without context. In either case, there is no substitute for seeing the skin of its wings or watching how it moves through the air. What we really wanted to know was how whales open their mouths underwater, nearly 90 degrees wide, to engulf a cloud of prey as large as their entire body in just a few seconds, and do it successfully many, many times every day. How do strap-like jaw muscles control that movement? What happens, for instance, with the muscles that form the floor of the mouth? All of these questions required getting close to a whale in the flesh. We needed to see the whole organism to understand the muscles, nerves, and flesh that fire the amazing process of lunge feeding, not just data points and bones. Chapter 10, A Discovery at Kvalfjörður. I took a break from writing field notes to gaze out at the fjord. The long summer light of early afternoon spilled gold on the dark greens and gray browns of rolling farmland. Our field clothes, drying on a line, snapped in the wind that rushed down the hillside. I glanced over at Jeremy, immersed in his laptop, tugging the loose collar of his sweater over his mouth. "Hey," I interrupted. "Want to go for a hike?" Jeremy waited a moment. "Sure," he said distractedly. Then he added in a low voice, glancing towards the kitchen, "Only if we bring beer." There were no whales to dissect at the moment, a mile down the road at the whaling station. The catch boats were far offshore, and I knew that we both could use a break from data inventory and manuscript writing. We slipped on our boots and unlatched the gate. Walking by the clothesline brought the deep aroma of whale oil, even after several washes, despite the sunlight and brisk air. We started uphill against the ever-present wind, climbing over fractured piles of purple-brown basalt, left by lava flows that had created the bedrock of Iceland more than 15 million years ago. Less than an hour later, sweating as the North Atlantic wind raced over us, we sat down on the cliff edge, overlooking the entire fjord. We shared the vista with fulmars, transoceanic birds that dutifully dive-bombed us to keep us away from their nests. Periodically, one would catch a steady wind and soar eye to eye with us over a cliff drop of hundreds of feet, the perfect profile of its wings keeping it effortlessly aloft. "Control surfaces, right?" I said to Jeremy. "Animals moving through fluid, be it air or water, control their path using the same physics that explain how a plane uses its wing flaps." "Yep," he replied as he sipped the foam off a well-shaken beer. "Same as the flippers that humpback whales use to turn on a dime underwater." Fulmar wings and humpback flippers owe their similar functions to the power of natural selection, producing the same solution from different starting points. In this case, shaping wings and flippers out of ancestral forelimbs in seabirds and whales for moving in vastly different worlds. From atop the mesa, we could see the whaling station ensconced at the end of Kvalfjörður, the long fjord that opened to the North Atlantic. Kvalfjörður literally translates from Icelandic as whale fjord, though locals assured me that the fjord's name is centuries old and likely for an errant whale passing by or washed ashore. The station had been constructed following World War II. During the war, the fjord's narrow entrance and deep coves were ideal shelter for convoys of Allied merchant vessels and warships against marauding German U-boats. I wasn't quite sure how big the whaling boats would look from this elevation, and the choppy waves were no decent guide for size either. Jeremy finally spotted the catch boat, cutting a tiny profile against the glare, its prominent wake and quick return signaling a successful hunt. We quickly finished our beers and scampered down the slope. Back at the cottage, we pulled our dirty shirts and pants off the clothesline and got in the car to head down the highway toward the station. Whales had brought us to Iceland, but there was also the happy accident of sharing the same advisor, Bob Shadwick, Jeremy's main advisor for his doctoral work and my postdoctoral advisor. As a comparative physiologist, Bob has the perspective of an engineer looking at the biological world. His expertise lies in understanding the inner workings of animals, the machine-like processes such as heart beating, lung expansion, and the spring of leg muscles that let animals live, breathe, and move. The three of us had already published a paper together before I finished at Berkeley, connecting our work on whale jawbones with tag data. We modeled the engulfment volume of one species, fin whales,